This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Morena, no mai kiti korero, welcome to the catch-up on Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi o na tangata o Manawatu. It is a Tuesday morning, and that means we turn our attention to local body politics, and in this instance, looking at Horizons Regional Council. And in the studio this morning, we have Rachel Kidwell, the chairperson. Good morning to you.
Tēnā koe.
I guess local body elections, people are starting to think about this now because we are in June and they are happening in September time?
October.
Yeah, then towards the end of the year. I should know because we are going to be covering not the Horizons elections, actually. We're covering Palmerston North City Council and Manawatu District Council, Manawatu Standard and MPR joining forces to cover those. But I understand there's going to be a Horizons video at some point that's played at those. But with that, you've had your first pretty much full... We should also caveat that this is the last time we'll be speaking to you for a while because of the election process and not allowed to campaign on air and all that stuff. But it would be interesting to know, 3 years as the chairperson of Horizons, was it everything you hoped and dreamed for?
Yeah, it was different to what I thought it would be. I mean, COVID changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I started off with a bit of a bang and then everything got put on the back burner because you couldn't really do what you wanted to do. But it has been amazing. I feel like I have achieved a huge amount. The feedback I've had has been incredible. And it's not just a change of that I became chair. We had quite a significant change in council.
Yeah.
So that meant, you know, suddenly have a more progressive council, you can move things in a different direction.
And it is a team job, isn't it? And arguably more of a team job at Horizons than perhaps with the other councils that I've just mentioned, because they have elections for a mayor, which is, you know, that's campaigning for leadership and almost a mandate to do things, although mandates at local body, that doesn't really work. But the chairperson at Horizons is voted from the group that is elected. So it is a real team effort.
Yeah, yeah. And so if my colleagues don't like what I'm doing, they can turf me out and choose someone else around the table who they think will do a better job. And that's not without precedent. In this term alone, there's been two councils that have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So Otago voted out their chair in the first year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Waikato has faced similar things in the last few months. And in some ways, it makes for, a more functional council than having a mayor that is completely at odds with their council and the council can do nothing about it.
Are you referencing any in particular?
We've heard of a few in the media. Yes. And so it means, I think it means I work harder to work with people to keep them on board. And the fun and games start about now because people are positioning for mm-hmm. the next term of council. So I know I'll probably be challenged and, people are looking at that now. But it doesn't stop the fact that I still just have to keep doing the work and carrying on the job as best as I can.
This is a wider discussion that we probably won't be able to get into enough detail today. But I mean, from what I understand, you treat the chairperson's role as a full-time job.
Mm.
You are not remunerated for a full-time job.
Oh, no, I am.
Oh, are you?
I am. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think even councillors are remunerated for a full-time job. I mean, quick plug if anyone's thinking of standing,
mm-hmm.
the base salary rate for Horizons is around about $50,000.
Okay.
And that's not a full-time job mm-hmm. as a councillor. I think every single person bar one around the table holds down other positions, either working independently or...
So again, a different beast to city and district council then, where the remuneration rates are often a topic of conversation.
Yeah, I think Palmerston North City is similar to Horizons now. They definitely got lifted up. It's based on population
mm-hmm.
and responsibility that way. And it does change. Like we've got two new councillors coming on next term because we've got the two Māori constituencies.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean the ratepayers pay anymore. It's the same pool of money that's set by the remuneration authority and that just gets stretched across.
You mentioned the Māori seats there. Have you gauged much interest in that? Or is there a sort of a campaign building for some people to bring some people up?
I have heard a few names floating around, of some names I'm sure will come across the ballot papers.
Mm-hmm.
Horizons has put together a couple of videos to encourage people to stand. So nominations open from the 15th of July, and one of those they've directed specifically at people on the Māori roll, or you know, people who want to stand for the Māori seats. You don't have to be on the Māori roll to do mm-hmm. that. And I'm always open and through the iwi relationships I have, I'm saying to them, if you've got anyone who's interested, come and talk to me. What is it like being a councillor? I mean, mm-hmm. You really don't know until you get there. So it's good to talk to someone who's got a bit of inside knowledge.
Lots of reading, I should imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, probably a third of your workload would be reading.
Yep.
It's the most sedentary job I've ever had. A lot of sitting around, talking and reading and talking and reading.
Yeah. So one assumes what you've been saying, you are going to be standing again.
Yeah, definitely am, and definitely would like to be chair again if I get the support of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's the same thing as when you stand for council, doing one term feels a bit like your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So standing down after that's a bit of a lost effort, and being chair is no different. I really feel like I've got the swing of the role,
mm-hmm.
and I've turned the ship slightly, and now I'd like to accelerate it a little bit.
And one thing that will be consistent is the CEO that the council and the chairperson will be working with, Michael McKay. Because I read the headline, applications are open for the CEO of Horizons. I went, where's Michael going? He can't possibly go anywhere. But this is just a formality.
Yes. Well, no, it's technically not.
Okay.
I mean, we interviewed seriously to look for other people because Michael's been in the role for 16 years.
Yep.
And I'm probably the last person I'm surprised at myself to think that someone who's been in the role 16 years and I wanted him back in, well, you'd think he'd be stale. You'd think he's, been around the traps a few too long. But we went out to market. We thought we needed to test it. We went out to market genuinely and had some really good applicants. But, Michael was head and shoulders above the rest, and he does a great job.
I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, I suppose, but I'm assuming he knows this is part of the job, that every 5 years, if he wants it to keep it, he has to apply again. But applying
it's
for
really
your job
strange.
Is a bit,
yeah. So he's having to do the job knowing that other people going for the job he's in. It's a very odd dynamic. It's one of those funny things about local government.
Is that the same in every?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
You have to. So you can do. So he's been reappointed for 5 years. So that's the maximum term we can do in his contract. But you can, at the end of that 5 years, roll over for another 2 years.
Oh, okay.
But then you must go out to market.
Yeah.
But often what people do is in the job ad, it has at the bottom, it says the incumbent is applying for the position.
Right.
Which basically says, they're going to keep the job, don't bother applying.
Yeah.
But when we went out, we didn't do that. We,
okay.
We genuinely wanted to check the market and see. It's a small world in New Zealand. I'm sure most people knew that Michael was reapplying for the job.
Oh, well, very good. Good to see him there for another 5 years. He is very good value. If people don't know who Michael McCartney is, keep an eye out for him. He's occasionally in the papers and on the Horizons website and stuff. Very good value. Let's have how did you spend Matariki, by the way? The first ever public holiday to recognise Matariki. I heard someone on the radio the other day saying it was the first time in New Zealand that we'd celebrated Matariki. I went, no, it's the public holiday.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't get up early because the morning before, on the Thursday morning, I had gone to a dawn blessing of the new pa lookout that was opened on Hiara Kotahi walkway above the Manawatu River. So I didn't really think I needed to do, 2 5 o'clock starts. But I went down, I live down by Ahemati Park on Buick Crescent, and there was, of course, the big celebration down there mm-hmm. that the city council put on in conjunction with Rangitane. So I went down there and spent the evening down there, and it was great. It was very busy.
Yes.
I was amazed at how many people were there. And my husband's grandchildren were in the Kapahaka group, so we got to watch that. And I loved the use of te reo through mm-hmm. the entire evening. It was almost like that was the primary language rather than the secondary one. And of course, it finished with the great fireworks, which I was home by then and I just watched them from my deck.
I guess the busyness of it, did you take time to do what Matariki, as we have learnt, to do what it's about, that sort of pause for reflection and think about ambition for the future and think about people we've lost, et cetera. Did you embrace that side of it, even sort of fleetingly?
Yeah, I had actually been thinking about that all week because we had, at Horizons, we had an all-staff meeting that was focused entirely on Matariki at the start of the week. And it was great. We talked through what the constellation meant and what all of the different parts of that constellation are about, mm-hmm. and that whole concept of thinking about what's to come. And it was in that meeting that we announced that we'd reappointed Michael to chief executive. So that was, you know, quite fitting, yeah, really, yeah, that we're looking ahead, and just reflecting on where we've been as well.
Very good. We are here with Rachel Keedwell, chairperson of Horizons Regional Council, on The Catch-Up. If you'd like to listen to this or previous editions of The Catch-Up series, just head to the website npr.nz/show/catch-up. Also on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your online listening. Turning to, I guess, things that have been making the headlines, really. Firstly, there are big snails in Totara Reserve that hitherto we didn't know were there.
Mm, yeah, so a few of them have been found, a couple of dead ones, so that's like the empty snail shell,
yeah.
But also one live one. And so the mystery here is this a remnant population that up till now hasn't been seen, or is it a population that someone has, you know, started, mm-hmm. by bringing them in? Because I know they definitely are in other areas, like I've been up the sledge track and seeing them up around there,
yeah.
And so it's not unheard of that they could still be there,
yeah.
And we've been doing heaps of predator control there, so maybe it's giving them a chance to come back.
Because I mean, these are not things that can cover great swathes of land. I guess you find them in pockets in, yeah, places, and they sort of stay there. Because,
yeah,
some of the theories I've heard is that perhaps they were washed down from somewhere else in the rain. Or as you said, a sort of an introduced population, in which case, do we encourage people to introduce populations of animals into places?
Well, not really, because unless you're doing it in a controlled and measured way, it could be a waste of those snails, mm-hmm. because they're highly susceptible to predators, you know, like the rats love them.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be taking them out of an area where they're doing okay and bringing them to somewhere where there's, you know, heaps of predators, and you lose them,
yep,
pretty much. They do go pretty quickly. But they're really special. I don't know. Have you seen one,
no,
before?
Not in person. I've seen them on the internet, but not,
yeah,
in person.
Yeah, because they're quite large. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen them, you know, the ones that eat the earthworms, but, you know, they basically devour entire earthworms, just suck them in. they're quite cool little animals. And you know, anything we can do, that's the reason people might have seen this on the media. It had quite a lot of pickup.
Yeah.
And it's just to get more information about where they might have come from, because the more we know, the more we can do to help protect them and maintain the population if there is one there.
Has this had an impact on the pest control or any of the activities that Horizons do in the area, knowing that this endangered population is there now? Are you going to up the game with the rat control? Or?
Yeah, well, they're already doing that, they're pushing that, but if they can identify and you know, and they go out and have a survey and find that there are more in a certain area, of course they would focus and target some, mm, of the control there to make sure, because, yeah, like you say, they're not wide-ranging animals, so if you can target the control, you've got a better chance of keeping them alive.
How is the whole pest control thing going with Horizons at the moment? I noticed Anthony Behrens on Facebook, I mean, it's an invasive species, it's not a pest necessarily, but he does a lot of the pine pulling, and he says just fighting a losing battle,
yeah,
at the moment.
Yeah.
Is that kind of true of all things?
Yeah. Well, I was walking the River Walkway the other day and looking at all of the old man's beard that's along there and thinking back to, I don't know, were you here when they had David Bellamy's Old Man's Beard Must Go campaign?
No.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, it must be a generational thing now. But yeah, they had this big campaign when first of all Old Man's Beard was found to be invasive, because, mm-hmm, it escaped from someone's garden in Taihape was where it came from.
Really?
It was actually the mayor's wife planted it. That's the rumour anyway.
Good Lord.
And this is where most of these plants come from. You know, they were garden,
yeah,
imports. And the really sad thing is, if the money had been invested then, like they had a campaign, but if they'd thrown a few million dollars at it back then, probably could have stamped it out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now it's impossible. You could put hundreds of millions of dollars into old man's beard control and not make a difference. And pines, have you seen the photos of some of the central Otago landscape?
No.
It's transformed. And again, if that's not controlled, it will become, instead of a golden tussock landscape, it will be a green forest, sort of deadscape, because it's the land, just there's nothing in there that will live out in terms of native species.
So, I mean, what do we do? I mean, like you say, you can't throw all that money at the problem. So what is the solution? Because we do want to encourage the natives to thrive.
Yeah, so in Horizons, where every regional council, you have a pest plan, and in that you have a list of the different criteria of species. So some of them, like old man's beard, I can't remember the technical term, it's like just managed control. So you're trying to contain it to some areas for some of these species, so not let it spread.
Yep.
But you've given up the battle in some areas, is essentially what you're saying. And that's at one end of the spectrum, right to the other, where if we see them come in, we would straight away pull out all stops to stop them. One of those is like wallabies. They've been sighted, a couple of potential sightings in the region. And so absolutely, you know, it's those first ones, if you can get it then, gosh, that saves so much money rather than later. And we've had other ones, like there was velvet leaf, which was an incursion that came in and beet crops that are planted in fields. And so they have things like, they had a dog that comes in, a sniffer dog that comes in and detects those. And then you've got a whole bunch in the middle that are, you know, sort of like you're progressively rolling them back. So we have targets each year to have fewer and fewer hotspots of those ones and progressively roll them back. But we did a stock take of our plan not that long ago, and we're not meeting those targets, you know, so we need to throw more resourcing at it or accept that a certain number of weeds are just going to get away on us.
And you know, there is a volunteer army out there that I'm assuming you would encourage people to get involved with, that run the trap lines and pull the pines and all that. I mean, they must be invaluable to this, because that keeps the financial component of the resourcing to a minimum.
Yeah, but I mean, the scale is so much bigger than what volunteers can do. So there's certainly a lot of money that does get thrown at it.
And you mentioned there's different categories. The rats and the stoats are the ones that I hear about the most. Are they in that sort of controlled one, or are they escalating?
They're not even in the plan.
Oh,
yeah, no, they're not. So most of the species that are in the plan, listed in the plan, as ones that we manage are your plant pest species.
Right.
So in terms of animals, that would be things like your wallabies, possums. Are possums in there? They must be, because we do a lot of control on them.
Mm-hmm.
These are sort of things I don't keep in my head. But but things like cats and rats and stoats, who are our major predators, they're not listed in there, which seems a bit crazy. But that's something to be reviewed.
Yes. And I'm sure it will be. Everything gets reviewed at council at some point. You've just got to wait for that slow wheel to turn, and then it will come up at some point. But getting back to sort of focusing on the good news, the giant snails at Totara Reserve, is there anything the public can do if they're up there? If they see one, do they get in touch with anyone, or do they count them, or is there anything they can do?
Yeah, if you see one, contact Horizons and let them know. Our number for everything is 0508 800 800. And
it seems like a silly phone call to make, though. I saw a giant snail at Totara Reserve.
No, you'll be met with great excitement.
Okay.
And a lot of people camp there, so we're even asking over time, you know, if you've been going there, do you remember seeing one even 10 years ago, whatever, just let us know, because again, the more information we can gather, the better it is for the picture for the snail.
And if someone did introduce the snail into Totara Reserve, do you have any words for them?
Just let us know. And where did it come from?
Yep.
That would be interesting too. Like, what's the base population that it came from?
Very good. One other thing that was making headlines in the past couple of weeks, obviously weather related, was the floodgate activity. It seemed to be mostly at Motoa. The floodgates, I think, engaged a couple of times there. And I suppose quite pleasing to know everything kind of worked.
Yeah, it's always pleasing to know after the fact. It was actually quite a widespread event, because we operated the Motua Gates, which is on the Manawatu River, and also the Makino Gates, which
I wasn't sure
Fielding.
About Makino, because I saw the thing, the news article saying they may be engaged, but I didn't see anything after that. So, okay, yes.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting in terms of the technology. So the Motua ones, they get opened. So that's to let the water down the spillway. And in the Makino ones, they get closed because what we're doing is diverting it. They have to close it off the main flow and divert it off to a spillway that way. So we always we don't talk about gate openings because in one case it's gate closings. So we're trying to talk about gate operations. But with the Motua one, it was really quite important that we did that because what was happening, they found out belatedly that the Oroa River, which empties into the Manawatu, was, because Manawatu was so high, the Oroa was backing up.
Uh-oh.
And then the main drain, which flows into the Oroa, that was backing up and that actually started to overtop. And that's the area where the marae at Rangiotu, the Rangimarie marae, that flooded back in 2015. And so, yeah, there was a team of people driving up and down that road all night.
Ready to flood the place again.
Yeah, ready to evacuate people on that road if it continued. But so what they did is they actually opened the spillway further to take more flow. And after about an hour, that released the pressure enough to drop it down. But that's part of the problem. Some of these rain events, particularly these thunderstorms, they're so unpredictable. You suddenly get a big burst in one very small area. Rather than, you know, typical ones where you can see it coming because, the measures, the monitors that are upstream, they can give you a really clear indication as the peak comes down the river.
It's a thing that I find very unique to New Zealand in thunderstorms when the rain comes down. When you've got a tin roof, you know when it's coming down. And the instance of no rain to lashing down on the roof, it's deafening.
Yeah, it was amazing, wasn't it? Wasn't it about 5 days worth of thunder and rain and wind?
We live on top of a hill in the middle of nowhere, so the thunder strikes were just everywhere. It was very pretty, but yeah, obviously, you know, there were implications. But I guess the fact that the floodgate operations were in effect, that goes to show how well the monitoring of all this works. Because I've been at Te Aonui, I've had a look around the sort of Civil Defence Centre, and just all the screens with all the floodgates and websites with details and information. It's like the hive mind.
Yeah, and there's some really great technology. I was up there the other day and they'd just put up a new app, whatever you call them. And so it had a big map of the area of the, you know, you could narrow down into any part of the region. And it had real time. So people could be out on site, take a photo of what's happening and load it to the app. And so people then back in headquarters can look and see photos of exactly what's happening everywhere around the region.
Wow.
And so it's that's the thing. It's the information so that you can manage it. Because we also, it wasn't just the gates that get operated. There was deployment of barriers. So in Foxton Beach, there's a barrier that gets put across the road to protect some of the lower-lying areas of houses. Because you have, not only do you have the increased flow in the river, when that coincides with the high tide, so the other barrier that was operated was in Whanganui. So you've got the high tide, you've got the high river flow, and then depending on atmospheric pressure, you get storm surges as well. So all of those things, you've
that's
got
a concoction and a half.
That's right. And so, you know, part of the thing we're looking at in Whanganui is we're rebuilding the moles, which are the bits of rock that stick out into the ocean, training the river structure.
Mm-hmm.
And you can build that to what the predicted sea level rise is, but to build it to coincide with high tide, high flows and atmospheric pressure, you have to build it another couple of metres higher.
Mm-hmm.
But you might only need that every so often.
But when you need it.
You'd certainly need it, yeah. So those are actually, we've got that at council today. We are talking about that, exactly that, deciding on what level to build those mole embankments to.
Okay, so you are considering not building them to the height that we, arguably the height that we would need them when we need them the most.
You can build them to, there's varying heights. That's the options, basically. But, of course, it comes with varying price tags.
Yeah.
And the price tag between the lowest and the highest is something like $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not cheap. It's really not cheap.
And it just strikes me, the government are looking at three waters reform at the moment, but they haven't mentioned anything about sort of flood water.
Should be four waters.
Yeah, because that is a huge concern. And Palmerston North, certainly, you just need to walk past, Mangaeoni Stream or down by the Manawatu River and see how much those can raise and lower with. Well, I would, my Scottish skin say fairly bad weather. It can be devastating.
Yeah, and it's an oversight, because the whole reason the Three Waters has come about is because so much of that infrastructure was built back in the 50s or 60s or whenever, and the pipes and the treatment plants, all of those things are aged. Well, it was exactly the same for the infrastructure for flooding that was built under Ministry of Works, mm-hmm. and then all has been handed over to regional councils, and we're relying on ratepayers. And a piece of work that the regional sector did recently to highlight to government how dire the situation is, it says that there's about $1.5 billion a year extra needed to go into flood protection just to maintain the levels of protection that we're used to.
Because the news, the narrative over the past few years is that flood protection is kind of okay. Around here, we hear of sort of improvements to things, and we hear of the floodgates working properly. But you're perhaps suggesting that that's luck more than good management.
Well, some of the parts need replacing. So you look at that Motua spillway; those gates. I mean, when were they? The 1940s or 50s. You know, at a certain point, they need replacing, and that's not going to be cheap. Where does that money come from? Fielding is expanding at a huge rate, and already their systems can't cope with the stormwater can't cope.
Yeah, we saw that recently.
That's right. And, you know, every time there's a flood, it's close. So some of these places, some of the flood protection needs to be upgraded or needs to just be maintained, and that comes at a cost.
Very good. We are pretty much out of time this morning, Rachel, but I guess given this is the last opportunity we'll get to speak to Horizons Regional Council before the local body elections, is any words of encouragement for listeners that might be interested in the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Give it a go. Come and talk to me. Talk to any of your local councillors. Have a look on the Horizons website. There's going to be information up there soon about what it means to stand. So 15th of July, nominations open. You've got a wee bit of time to make up your mind. It's pretty easy to do, and it's a great job. It's a great way to serve your community. It's a great way to make a difference, and you learn so much. You know, really, my life has changed immensely.
Well, you've demonstrated it today. You did deeply detailed descriptions about floodgates and goodness knows what.
Yeah, exactly. Things I never thought I would know about or care about. You get to understand the world of local government, which to most people they don't really care about until it's not working. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that goes in to make sure it keeps working.
And remember, if you want to complain about the buses, it's not Palmerston North City Council, it's not Manawatu 2 District Council, it's Horizons. Cheap shot. Rachel Keedwell, chairperson for Horizons, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're most welcome.
And remember, if you want to listen to this or previous editions of the Catch Up series, head to the website npr.nz/show/catch-up. Back tomorrow at 8:30 with Matt Dallas from the Manawatu Standard. Do join us then. Mathiwa. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.